Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I have blended two talks together tonight. Elements of the superconscious, and also a second talk, which are the seven paths of superconsciousness. And I'm going to roll them into one, because I seem to have missed one of these out somewhere. When we talk about the superconscious, for most of us, this is just hearsay. We have to remember, however, that superconscious experience is had in a physical body. The master himself becomes a master in his physical body. Therefore, the potential lies within that physical body of every one of you to have superconscious experience. I'm not talking about something completely unattainable for you. It isn't as if I, who have had many superconscious experiences, it isn't as if I have had an immaculate conception. I am one of you. I'm a human being. The potential of my physical body is not much different from yours. And therefore, what I have to say tonight relates to you. The human body and its inner vehicles, which we began to explore last night, has incredibly delicate mechanisms for balancing itself. Last night we saw how we could liken the human body unto a fountain, that the human body maintains its shape despite the fact that it loses all its complement of atoms within a short period of time, about 18 months. Man is like a fountain. The fountain's water molecules are not there 2 seconds after. They have been completely replaced, yet the shape of the fountain remains. Now, when we go further into man and examine the delicate mechanisms which provide for him balance and homeostasis, we find that man's qualities could be symbolized, the qualities of his physical body, his etheric body, his astral body, his mental and his spirit, could be symbolized by the caduceus. The caduceus was a 3-rodded instrument which was carried by the god Hermes, or Mercury. This instrument was said to symbolize the capacity of Hermes, or Mercury, to make contact with the gods. He was called the messenger of the gods. And it is said that man himself possesses the capacity to reach the gods. Man has this capacity because of an old mythological tale of Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods and brought it to man. And just as one flame can light up many candles without losing its strength and power, so the bringing of fire, spiritual fire, to man by Prometheus lit all men, provided them with the spark of divinity and the potential for superconsciousness. Man's physical body beautifully demonstrates the balancing forces of this caduceus. We could refer, first of all, however, to man's etheric body. And the yogis say that man's etheric body is divided into 3 huge tracts. There is the tract of Ida, the tract of Sushumna, and the tract of Pingala. And these are said to be 3 snakes, or 2 snakes entwined about a third. And this symbol of the caduceus is that symbol of the etheric body. Man possesses in the central core of his brain and spinal cord Sushumna, a snake, a serpent, a winged serpent, Even here in America, in South America especially, we know of the winged serpent. It is said that when Ida and Pingala are in fine balance, then the plumed serpent of Sushumna enables the man to fly away, to leave his body, and to become virtually a god for the moment. The East talk about the arousal of Kundalini. The West talks about the opening of the third eye. All these are synonymous for the act of achieving superconsciousness, of going to sit at the master's table, not merely being fed with the crumbs as we are in ordinary life from the tables of masters, but to have the capacity to go and seat yourself at the table of the masters, the ability to reach superconsciousness. Many of us practice meditation, and indeed, some of us often feel, when we have come from a meditation, that the experiences of that meditation have been, far from energizing us, they have exhausted us. And in fact, the physical body has a dual capacity. The physical body has the capacity to receive from the outside world. We may as well, if you like, put in the physical body now. We may put in the head of man, which would have this Sushumna part of it, anchored, as it were, to the third ventricle of the brain. We could put the rest of man in like that, and we have, as it were, man superimposed on the caduceus. Now, man's body, physical body, as well as this etheric one that we have described, has tremendous capacities for balancing inner and outer forces. You haven't got to be a doctor to know that the physical body can adjust itself to heat. It can adjust itself very, very well. There is the story, a true one, of a physiologist, a Frenchman, who tested this theory out, that man's body could stand intense heat. And what he did was to take a piece of steak, put it on a plate, and walk into a room, a heated room, like one that you might call here a sauna bathroom, or what we would call in England a Turkish bath. And he went into this room, and the temperature was raised to 50 degrees higher than boiling water. And he stayed in there half an hour with this piece of steak on a plate. And though the temperature of the room was such that glasses of water were boiling all around him, he survived at this huge temperature. When he came out, the piece of steak was cooked, and he ate it. But he, the living steak, had survived. This shows you that we have this tremendous capacity to balance the outer forces of our environment. The heat does not lift our temperature much above 98 or 99 degrees Fahrenheit, no matter what it is. Similarly, we balance the forces of light in the body. We have a sphincter in the eyes which shuts out too much light. We have many, many capacities to balance the forces of the environment in our physical body. And this is how we keep alive. But ladies and gentlemen, man is just not a physical body. Man contains these inner vehicles. He contains, as we saw last night, an astral body in which he thinks. And this astral body, more than anything, is linked to the wings of the caduceus. For it is in the astral body that man may leave his physical and fly into the ethers. And we must now begin to understand that the astral body of man, the etheric body which never leaves the physical for very long and lies in close apposition with it, the etheric body of man also has incredibly delicate mechanisms. The inner environment of man changes continuously. One man, like you and me, on the path of unfoldment, could experience in 3 seconds the heights of meditation, could experience in 3 seconds sufficient spiritual forces flowing into us as we might not experience in 200 lives on this earth as a primitive man. In meditation, it is possible to draw down tremendous forces from a higher world so that these virtually flow into the aura, into the inner nature of man in vast conflagrations. We have delicate mechanisms for balancing this. We have, as it were, four centers or chakrams. And these four centers are always related to an outer gland. If it is the thyroid gland, we have this related to the throat center. Now this throat chakram allows forces to impact it from within and forces to impact it from without. It is a delicate mechanism. It rotates and shimmers as it does rotate. And clairvoyants describe these little radiant suns in our etheric bodies, which are so receptive not only to the outer heat of the world, the environment, but also to spiritual forces, spiritual fire flowing into us. We have delicate mechanisms to balance all these. And so we see that man is subject to intense forces from within, just as he is from without. And so we begin to ask ourselves, what then is superconsciousness? What is superconsciousness? We could virtually repeat the drawings that I have already given you here again and again with regard to the physical body. We could talk about the venous system, the system of the body that carries the venous blood, the veins. We could say that the venous system is opposed or balanced by the arterial system of the body. The venous system and the arterial system. And these two make up the blood system of man, which carries the prana from the lungs and distributes it. It is the blood that carries the prana of man and distributes it through his etheric body into the chakrams. And we could again talk about all sorts of other forces which balance the human body in the face of impact. We could talk about where these three snakes meet as being endocrine glands. And we have series of endocrine glands strategically placed in the body, which again balance the forces of the inner worlds and the outer worlds. This you must understand, that man is a meeting ground of the interplay of inner and outer forces. And you and I are nothing but electrical charges wrapped up into one delicate organism. You and I are a spark of the divine. I am not the calcium of my bones, the metal calcium of my bones. I am something more than this. I am not the iron of my blood, though I carry this around and it serves me well. I am something more than this. I am a spark of the divine, and that spark of the divine shows itself in electrical phenomena in my body, in my mental body, in my astral body, in my etheric body, and even as nervous conduction in my physical body. I am a spark of the divine. And my whole aim and purpose in this life is to unite my spark with the spark of God Himself, or if you like, with the one flame. And so we describe ourselves, as it were, and we will hear more about this when we consider the talk on reincarnation, which I understand is tomorrow afternoon. We talk about the descent of the monad, you and I descending as a spark of the divine from one flame. One flame shatters and showers into 63,000 million sparks of the divine, or monads, which descend into the planetary scheme known as the Earth. And there they come into contact with matter. And the way in which it is done is this: for the spark of the divine to enter in with its electrical nature, to enter into a human body, and through the human body to come into contact with matter. And by this contact with matter, eternally incarnating for many, many hundreds of lives, he learns to dominate the material substance. If you like, if you're a chemist, to dominate atoms which are packed 2n squared in their orbits. This is what the purpose of incarnation is. Now man has the possibility to do justice, to control, to dominate matter, and to return to the Father's house. But we do not return to the Father's house in one sudden event. There are, as it were, opportunities to return to the Father's house and glimpse the glory of that house from which we once emerged. And this is superconsciousness. To understand superconsciousness, we need to examine certain analogies. I can't describe the experience of superconsciousness to you merely in finite words of English, finite terms. I have to use other mechanisms. One of the great mechanisms that we can use, and I must repeat this analogy, even though some of you heard it the last time I was here, because it is so relevant. One of the great analogies that explains what superconsciousness is to compare yourself to the flowering of a plant, For you see, the plant kingdom is flowering into perfection. There are millions and millions of plants flowering into masterdom, into perfection. There are very, very few human beings flowering into perfection. One here and there, possibly not more than two every year on this planet, flowering into perfection to become the master. Let's compare by analogy the similarity of a flower, as it were, blooming, opening, becoming radiant, and the growth of a man into a master, in which he becomes radiating in a massive aura. Let's compare the two processes. Here we have the seed of a plant thrust into fertile soil. Here we have the descent of a monad, a human monad, into an incarnation on earth. The seed of man thrust into the harsh soil of material existence in a reincarnation. Let us consider first of all the seed of the plant as it begins to put out roots and part of itself into this harsh soil. And by this method, it begins, as it were, to garner all that the soil can offer it. From the harsh particles, it begins to absorb the materials from which it can grow, and its roots flourish as they go down into the soil. Similarly with man, savage man, the young soul, as it were, begins to put down his roots into the soil. We learn through many lives to draw sustenance from the material world. Going back to the plant now nourished from the soil begins to put part of itself upward. It begins to, as it were, assert itself in a new dimension. Part of itself, the stem, moves into a new world. And there it begins to unfold its higher nature. Not the roots, but its leaves. Now, as it unfolds its leaves, these leaves begin to pick up a different sort of material, a different nutrition. The energy of the sun is picked up by its higher nature. In photosynthesis, this energy is absorbed and held and stored in the form of glucose. Similarly, man on the earth begins to tire of the lower world, of the material world. He tastes all that the material world has to offer in his many lives, and he sickens of it. He sickens of the same old rigmarole of being born into material existence and experiencing the sorrows, the joys, and so on of this transient life on earth. And this man now begins to put up part of himself, which is called in Eastern philosophy an antakarana. He begins to put out part of himself into a world of new dimensions. We may call it inner space, if you wish. And this antakarana, or rainbow bridgehead, begins to move into this new world, and there parts of itself now begin to open up. Now the energies of the inner world gained by meditation are absorbed by the man, the higher part of the man. In the plant analogy, the plant begins to produce great groweth, there is a point of stress and of tension at its growing point or meristem where the glucose and materials are brought into the bud. And if you had walked this planet 90 million years ago, you would never have seen a flowering plant, nothing but green plants. Would you not have marveled as this growing point suddenly burst into the flowering plant like that, the blossom? You would have marveled at it. You would have marveled at this green plant suddenly producing such splendor. Notice the change in the plant. Notice that before it occupied a small region of material, green material or chlorophyll. Now, because of its sudden flowering, its ring pass not, its sphere of influence has increased tremendously. Now the fragrant, the flower may reach to the bottom of the garden. Its aura, its ring pass not, has extended again and again and again. Perhaps bees 9 miles away may pick up the fragrant scent of this, as it were, perfected flower. Similarly with man. Man now begins to unfold an inner structure. His soul, by means that we discussed last night, begins to open its tiers of petals. The 3 tiers of petals begin to open, and man begins to reach, as it were, perfection. The egoic lotus of man is opened. This is what we call superconscious experience. The experience of the higher worlds. The experience which comes with blossoming forth into man's higher nature. What do men and women who have had this experience describe superconscious experience? Tonight we must learn the mechanism of it. All of them seem to describe 3 qualities of superconscious experience. All of them report, for instance, the feeling, the intense inner feeling, whilst it lasts, the superconscious experience, the intense inner feeling of power, omnipotence, omnipotence, all power. In that moment of superconscious experience, they feel as if they were all powerful and, in fact, part of the power behind the universe. What sensation does this give to them? It gives them the sensation of ecstasy, tremendous ecstasy. Similarly, they report at the same time when they return, it doesn't matter whether it's Plato or in our own times, Dr. Buck or Pythagoras or whoever it may be, they all report at the same time a sensation of omniscience, of all-knowing. Omniscience, of all-knowing. And with this there is the sensation of light, intense light, inner light. They describe inwardly a light that is brighter than 10,000,000 suns, all within them. Ecstasy, high feeling, and some of them will say it is the ecstasy that makes orgasm of the lower nature seem as nothing. And the third factor that they describe is the ability somehow to manipulate time. Time for them in this higher state of consciousness, time for them begins to slow down. Or they may even accelerate it and make the time go fast. So they could see a period of 10,000 years of the growth and fall of a civilization in one glimpse. The ability to manipulate time. And this is experienced as a sensation of yoga, of yoking themselves, of being in union with this infinitely large entity or life that they have reached in superconsciousness. So we begin to understand something of the elements of superconsciousness. What is the nature of the superconscious experience and the mechanism that man possesses in order to reach it? Many people confuse the 3 states of consciousness known to man. And these 3 states of consciousness are these. Firstly, there is the subconscious. Then there is Jung's collective unconscious. And then there is the superconscious state. never mind, as it were, ordinary waking consciousness. Let me stress them again so we can sort them out tonight, and for all time you will know exactly what superconsciousness is. There is the subconscious, there is the collective unconscious, and there is superconsciousness. Even the Casey Foundation, the ARE Foundation, does not seem to be very clear with regard to Edgar Casey himself as to what he was experiencing, whether it was his subconscious or whether it was a superconscious experience or what. I can only give my own opinion on it. My opinion is that Edgar Casey went into a deep state in which his consciousness, as it were, was replaced by a higher being. And I believe that events will show, and I hope to lead a paper on the subject, present a paper on the subject. I believe that Edgar Casey was overshadowed again and again by a person known as the Master DK. He who is known as the dispossessed, the Master Joao Pul, who also dictated the greater part of the secret doctrine to H.P. Blavatsky, and 30 years later dictated the teachings of the ancient wisdom through Alice Bailey. If you compare many of the writings, the case histories of Edgar Casey, you will find great similarities between the teachings through those case histories of one and the teachings of Alice Bailey and H.P. Blavatsky. I'm not saying that the Tibetan master occupied or used Casey throughout his whole life, no. I'm saying that about from the year 1920 onwards, something began to change in Edgar Casey's case history. Suddenly there was an oriental flavor to them. Suddenly he began to talk about chakrams and four centers, and he began to refer to Eastern teachings. Why? Because the vehicle that had used Casey before that, the master that had used Casey before that, was replaced by an oriental, and this was the Tibetan master DK. What then is the subconscious? What do we mean when we talk about the subconscious? Because we have to have these classifications clearly in our minds. The subconscious is that huge field of mental activity which is sunk below our awareness. We're inclined to forget the fact that there is a consciousness that makes our eyes blink. There is a consciousness that moves the intestines. We don't have to tell the intestines to move. Some consciousness controls them. Some consciousness will clear the eye of foreign matter by blinking. There is therefore a subconscious in man which is responsible for the functioning of the lower nature, the autonomic nature of man, the subconscious. And many people mistakenly in the field of the occult try and bring the subconscious out. And the occult teachings are, don't bring the subconscious to the surface. It's bad enough when it has to be done by psychoanalysis. It is wrong to bring it out, especially in hypnosis. Hypnosis has, as it were, a bad effect on man when that subconscious is brought upward by mechanisms of putting, as it were, the vehicle to sleep. And so we have to now begin to regard the next kind of consciousness, and that is Jung's collective unconscious. Jung, the great psychologist Carl Jung, who described a collective unconscious, which he said influenced man. What did he mean by this? He meant that you and me and all of us, because we are anatomically constructed the same, all of us have, as it were, a common foundation of mental and emotional patterns. For instance, if you have ever held a child, a baby, a newborn baby in your arms, you will note that the child will clutch and hold onto your fingers very, very firmly. It has a pattern established in it which is common to all human babies. to clutch and to hold the finger when you put it into its hand. This fear of falling also is present in the child. When the child is held in an uneasy position, it begins to clutch. It is in fear of falling. Now, all of us possess these cultural patterns that we have inherited, as it were, from a collective subconscious of man. We all of us, as children, tend to fear the dark. And this is a cultural pattern, part of our collective unconscious. Many of us fear things that are new. Average man doesn't like new things. He fights them off until he understands them, and then he accepts them. There is the natural fear of fire that we all possess, and so on. There are, as it were, many patterns of behavior which we all of us cling to. We are born into existence on the earth, but that existence is somehow moderated, affected by patterns of culture which have been established in the long ages in the past. Here you are, and you tend to be attached to these patterns of cultural behavior, and Jung called them the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious. And there they are. And when we are confronted with a sudden situation, we immediately, in the absence of being able to think, we suddenly rely on ancient patterns. We're suddenly confronted with darkness, and immediately we have a fear of darkness. We don't trust it. And so we, all of us, possess this sort of anchorage, an anchorage to a collective unconscious, a series of patterns that we have inherited down through the ages. This is what is meant by a collective unconscious. How is this relevant to you and me? And how is it relevant to superconscious experience? And what is superconscious experience? Average man, people who are almost savage in outlook, tend to rely entirely on that collective unconscious. You can talk about tribesmen who act and react in a certain way. When there is thunder and lightning, they automatically believe that this is an exchange of words, angry words, between the gods. However, as we progress in unfoldment, in spiritual unfoldment, we begin to break these ties with the collective unconscious. We begin to snap them. They no longer hold us. We learn not to follow the laws of nature. We begin, as it were, to be governed by new ideas and new emotional patterns. We begin to, as it were, reason things out. And we know that there's nothing to fear in the dark. And so long as we keep a healthy distance from fire, there's nothing to fear in fire. In fact, we continually develop, and these primitive links that we once had begin to snap. Man's consciousness may grow to such an extent that he is completely freed from these ancient patterns. And you and I, on the path of spiritual development, have to learn to do just this. And if we do it too quickly, too rapidly, if we believe that we can have freed ourselves from these ancient patterns and we possess a personality that is unstable, then we are in danger. When we are put to the tests of initiation, when the iron is put into the fire and made and tempered into steel, sometimes we become unstable. Sometimes we turn topsy-turvy because we have not got the links, the old links, to hold on to and tell us how to act in a given situation. Sometimes the stress is so intense on the path that we begin to flounder. We haven't got the inner guts, the inner moral courage to face the situation. And we can no longer call on those ancient patterns to say how we should act. The patterns are no longer there available to us, and we flounder. We suffer from schizophrenia, mental imbalance, and people say he's gone off his rocker. Yes. And it is a dangerous path if you take a path of occult unfoldment and don't tread the classical path that has been taught to us by the masters of the wisdom. There is a path, there is a way to a higher state, a higher condition, which I'm describing here tonight as superconsciousness. And if we don't heed this, the teachings of the masters who have trod that path before us, we become prone to nervous breakdown and so on. But many survive. Despite all this, many of them survive. And it is in their new freedom that they break the old chains of instinct. And it is then that the soul begins to take notice of this individual. A person who breaks the old ways, the old habits. It is then that the soul, the higher triad of Atma, Buddhi, and Manas, begins to take heed of its vehicle, its lower vehicle, or if you like, its lower triad. Once it has severed its old patterns, once it has new values. And so we begin to get an establishment of the higher nature with the lower nature, the nature of man's soul with its vehicle, the consciousness. And from now on, I describe what I call the collective superconscious. The collective superconscious. Because in this higher world, which has been trod by the saints and the masters before us, whether they were Buddhas, whether they were Christ or Jesus or Muhammad, makes no difference. But they trod that path into the higher world, and they have left behind them certain patterns of behavior which were connected with them. They may have left a pattern of behavior like a sphere. They may have left behind them a pattern of behavior symbolized by the cross, or by a mandala, or by a pyramid, or whatever they may be. And this realm is filled with the patterns of behavior left behind by those who have trod into the higher world. And then we, once we have severed the link with the collective unconscious, now we begin to establish links with these higher worlds, with the symbols, with the vortices of energy, with the mandalas, call them what you like, of the higher world. And this is what we do in meditation. This is what we're trying to establish, links, anchakarana, the higher nature of man, the lower nature of man, and the anchakarana. We try and establish these links. And more that we establish them, the more our auras are fed by them. From these great symbols, whether they are a master themselves, or whether they are just pure cosmic symbols, down comes flows of energy of all types, pouring into man's aura, enriching him, so that he becomes ablaze with those energies. And this is what I call the collective superconsciousness. And it is that which we learn to establish links with when we begin to meditate, when we practice the higher disciplines. These new anchors are the strands of the superconscious path which the young initiate begins to climb. He has to climb, as it were, a Jacob's ladder to a higher world. He has to construct that ladder himself and then mount it and reach to that higher world. And the Bible is full of references to it. So are the Upanishads. So are all the great classical teachings. The truth is that man has two collective unconsciousnesses. Those of two kingdoms. The lower kingdom, the third kingdom, the animal kingdom, that we, many primitive men, still hold links with their animal nature, which guides them, helps them through difficult situations, and they may just revert to the animal condition themselves to get through that crisis. Or they may, as it were, rely on the fifth kingdom of nature. And it is the fifth kingdom of nature that I have been describing here now. They may build a Jacob's ladder to that fifth kingdom. Now there are many such examples of men who have, as it were, climbed a Jacob's ladder. Many, many such examples. And the higher you go, the more symbols there are, more and more of them. And the links that you had established in the primitive stages of your spiritual development now become growing outward, as it were, branching again and again into a whole network of a higher world. I want to read to you an extract of an experience of illumination and ecstasy by a typical person reaching into these higher worlds and see how it demonstrates what I have been saying. The experience that I'm going to read to you, and it's not very long, is that of Edward Maitland, who was the co-worker of Anna Kingsford. Edward Maitland discovered that during reflection on an idea, and this is the world of ideas, this is the fifth kingdom, is the world of ideas. Edward Maitland discovered that during reflection on an idea, related ideas became visible, so to speak, in a long series, apparently back to their source, which to him was the divine spirit. By means of concentrating on the series of ideas, he made the effort to press on to their origin. And he describes as follows. Once well started on my quest, I found myself traversing a series of spheres or belts, the impression produced being that of mounting a vast ladder, stretching from the circumference of my personality towards the center of a system, which was at once my own system, the solar system, the universe, the three systems being at once diverse and yet identical. Presently, by a supreme effort and what I felt must be a final effort, I succeeded in polarizing the whole of the converging rays of my consciousness into the desired focus. And at that same instant, as if through the sudden ignition of the rays thus fused into unity, I found myself thus confronted with a glory of unspeakable whiteness and brightness and of a luster so intense as well nigh to beat me back. To put it into simple terms, he said that he was pondering on a particular idea. He was pondering on a particular idea. Here he was, and he had in his mind a particular idea. And then, as he explored that idea, suddenly he saw other ideas. And he began to merge himself with these other ideas, and then, by a tremendous act of focusing his awareness, he followed one of these through, and suddenly he exploded into a higher world of tremendous whiteness and brightness. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have studied my tapes or heard me give the talk on superconsciousness through meditation, that's exactly as I describe it. The ability to visualize an idea or an ideal and to focus on it so that it takes you through into a higher world, up a ladder if you wish, into a higher world. And there are many, many descriptions of this sort of experience. And in the second half of my talk, I'm going to describe the seven safe, classical ways of reaching those higher states, up Jacob's ladder, if you wish, or through the use of the Antakarana. And all of us tend to use or need to use different methods according to our own qualities. According to the rays of our various bodies, we tend to choose. We tend to find any one of these seven paths to be more suitable for us than others. It's a hard path that we have to take, not because it is so painful, not because it is so rough, but because it is so unlike what we are used to on earth in ordinary waking consciousness, no matter which of the seven paths we take. The path that we take is not something dramatic. It often needs persistence and courage. If you ask me what two qualities I could, as it were, put at the basis of my own success in reaching superconsciousness, I would say the two qualities most needed, in the beginning anyway, are persistence and courage. Persistence in what you are doing in your meditation and courage to keep on with it no matter what is experienced, to keep on with it knowing that you are divine and that this is a divine way. And when that superconscious experience comes, it always comes unexpectedly. as it did to Maitland, the example that I have just given to you. And it is always through the most simple and unostentatious mechanism. As the New Testament says, except ye be as little children, ye cannot reach the kingdom of heaven. It is through a simple mechanism. I know of someone, a very nice and spiritual person, who joined up with a spiritual group and soon rose to lead that group, and she became president of it, and she presided over huge conferences, and she felt that because she had reached the leadership of that group that she was entitled to superconscious experience just because she had become leader of that group. Now that sort of reasoning does not function in the higher worlds. It is attention to the simple things. People think that what they have to do is to become so harmonious that they never have conflict in their lives. If you only knew it, it is by crisis and by conflict that we grow towards superconsciousness. The analogy of the flower showed just this. The very part of the flower that the very part of the plant that produced the flowering was the part that was under the greatest stress, the bud that had to burst. And it was a point of crisis in that plant, and it was that that produced the flowering. And it's the same with us. You know, there was once a young neophyte who prayed loudly and longer than anyone else in the ashram. And he did this for many, many years. At last, in desperation, he called loudly to his master and said, "Master, I have prayed long and devotedly for enlightenment. Why have I not been heard?" And the master answered him, "We have been but waiting to hear ourselves speak. You have shouted so." People try so hard with their personalities, when what is needed is to see a whisper. To see a whisper. You can't do that if you're pushing your personalities to their utmost. What is needed is also to hear a candle flame. And I choose my words very, very carefully. They are not meant to brush you aside with red herrings. To hear a candle flame, we have to become devas. Last night I talked about the body becoming an eye. You have to learn that you must be able to see things with the ears and to hear things with the eyes. For in the supersensitive person, the whole aura is an eye. Many hierarchies of life that use this planet for evolution, other than our own and the animal and the plant, the deva kingdoms, they see what we hear. They hear what we see. For them, a symphony is a glorious spectacle of color. For them, a vivid portrayal of color is a violent expression to them of sound. They hear color. And it is the same with us. We must, as it were, learn to expand ourselves. Always remember that big things have come from the smallest beginning. Certainly, superconsciousness is for very simple, and that is focusing the mind to a pinpoint. From the pinpoint, there comes the blazing into superconscious experience. Maitland has just told you this. From the smallest things and from the simplest beginnings come the most complex. Galileo watched the swaying of a chandelier and produced the pendulum of the clock. Penicillin was discovered from a moldy crust of bread. The greatest life-saving factor that we know today, penicillin, the antibiotic. And superconsciousness is often found in places where you would least expect to find it. It often comes to you through, as it were, unexpected ways. Swedenborg was called the spiritual Columbus. The spiritual Columbus. And how like a Columbus he was. But what did Columbus do when he made the discovery of the New World, the country you live in now? Columbus sailed west to find a land which he believed to be in the east. He sailed west to find it. And he landed first on an island, not on the huge continent which lay behind the island. It was very unexpected for him, those discoveries.